Detta är en podcast från Dagens Näringsliv.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
So you got to be willing to be wrong.
Vår celebre gjest er Aswath Damodaran. Han er professor i finans ved Stern School of Business, New York University. Verdens kanskje fremste ekspert på verdsettelse av selskaper gir sine beste råd I denne spesialutgaven av Finansredaksjonen. Det en podcast som lages av oss her I Dagens Næringsliv. Mitt navn Terje Erikstad, og jeg finansredaktør. Resten av denne podcasten foregår på engelsk.
Welcome, Mr. Damodaran.
Thank you for having me. Yeah.
So, could you present yourself for Norwegian audience?
I'm Aswath Damodaran. I teach corporate finance and valuation at New York University. I've been doing it for almost 40 years now. And I describe myself first and foremost as a teacher. I tend to dabble in lots of different topics. I'm interested in lots of different issues. And I consider myself not an expert on any of those issues, but I'm just interested.
So, when you value a company, what is the main issues you are dealing with? How in kind of from the most important to the least important?
The first thing is before you value a company, you need to understand what it does. What does it make? Who buys it? What makes it good? What makes it bad? Who are the competitors? In other words, understanding the landscape of business is critical to valuing a company. Now, if you don't know what your company actually does, it's almost impossible to value the company, even if you have all of the tools and the techniques for valuing companies. That's why I said to value companies, you need to understand business from the inside out. So if you're valuing a semiconductor company, you don't need to know how semiconductor chips are made, but you need to know how they're used. What makes some chips better than others? Why are NVIDIA chips better suited for AI than Intel chips? So that requires at least an understanding of the core products or services, which is one reason it's often easier to value, business to consumer companies, B2C companies, than B2B companies, because B2C companies, we tend to be the consumers. We've all used Uber. So to value Uber, you don't need to say, what does Uber do? How does it work? To value NVIDIA is more difficult because you and I don't buy computer chips. We buy stuff with chips in them. It makes it a little more difficult, but you at least can get a core understanding of the business before you value the business. Hmm.
So really understanding the company is key. But then you have to make some projections. And what is the key driver for value for a company?
I mean, valuation is always about the future. No matter how rich your past data is, it's what the future delivers that drives the value of your company. Which means you can have companies with great past but not very good futures, or companies with very little in the past but with an incredibly solid. So Arm, which is the other AI company that went public a couple of weeks ago, it's a company that's not been around for more than a few years. It's not got much in its past, but it's got a whole lot of expectations for the future that are driving its value. To make those estimates, though, you got to be willing to be wrong. Why? Because you're making your best estimates, but things can change on you. I give the example of somebody trying to value a hotel in 2019. So let's say it's a hotel with a long history. You sit there, it's Hilton. You're valuing Hilton, you've got 20 years of history, you project numbers out, you think you've done a pretty good job. But 6 months later, COVID hits, every hotel in the world gets shut down, your projections are all turned to dust. You can't beat yourself up about it. It wasn't your fault that in 2009 you didn't project COVID in 2020. But that's the kind of uncertainty that's going to mean that the actual numbers are different from the expected numbers. And that's why we demand a risk premium for investing in things where we face more uncertainty. You can't, you know, bring in that uncertainty or make it go away, but you can charge a higher rate of return for investing in those companies.
What's special with you is that you publish all your analysis, your valuations, so everyone can see when you are wrong or when you are right. And one of the companies you have valued several times is Tesla. And Tesla is well known in Norway because we have a lot of Tesla cars here. Would you say that, what's your experience of valuing Tesla? Were you wrong every time, or?
I've been more wrong than right on Tesla because it's a company that I think whose story has shifted over time. It started as a luxury automobile company. In 2013, when I valued Tesla, the price of a Tesla was 3 to 4 times the price of a mass market automobile company. Around 2015 or 16, it was clear they were going to become a mass market automobile company. But at that time, they had an energy arm. It wasn't clear whether they were going to be a car company or an energy company. In 2019, it looked like they'd gone back to being just a mass market automobile company. Today, there's a very real possibility that it's not a car company, but a robo-taxi company where the car company is at the front for a very different business model. It's what makes the company fascinating. Now, I've bought Tesla a couple of times during its lifetime because I felt it's undervalued. And I've sold Tesla a couple of times because I thought it was overvalued. Now, am I going to beat myself about the fact that I've been wrong? No, it's the nature of investing is sometimes you're going to be wrong. And especially on the companies that are exceptional, and Tesla has been an exceptional company, you should expect to be more wrong than right because that's the nature of exceptional companies. They're beating your expectations at each step of the game. I find the company to be fascinating. The most recent valuation of the company I did was almost a year old, so it's time for me to revisit it, especially now that the robo-taxi dream at least has a potential of becoming something real. But I think it's a company that keeps shifting on you. It's an amorphous company where your story keeps changing. As your story changes, your value changes as well.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact? You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
You did mention the chip producer, NVIDIA.
Yeah.
You have valued it and you have invested it in. And that's a company that has really gone like a rocket in value. What do you think about the value as of now? And how should we think about a company like NVIDIA?
I mean, NVIDIA, I bought NVIDIA in 2018 at a time when its stock price was around $30 per share. And I didn't buy it because I saw AI on the horizon. I couldn't even have told you what AI was in 2018. And I tell people sometimes, you know, your best investments happen because you got lucky. I mean, the reason NVIDIA's stock price has soared is it's the company best positioned to actually take advantage of AI in a tangible way. The way I describe it, creates the plumbing for AI. I mean, you might have all this neat stuff you do with ChatGPT, but AI is all about taking huge amounts of data and immense computer processing power to create things that are practical for other businesses. And NVIDIA is there producing the chips. So it's actually one of the few companies where AI is just not a buzzword. It's actually something that's driving revenues of the company. In 2023, the AI market right now, the chip market, is about $25 billion. And NVIDIA controls about 60 to 80% of the market. It's somewhere around there. So it dominates the market, but it's a small market right now. What's driving NVIDIA's stock price up is that $25 billion AI market could be as large as $350 billion 10 years from now. And if NVIDIA keeps its dominance, it's going to be a huge increase in revenues for the company. That's what's being built in. So it's caused the stock price to soar. So this summer when I valued NVIDIA, I said, okay, there's an AI story here, which I didn't see in 2018 when I bought the company. I see the price going up because of the story, but does the story justify how much the price has gone up? So what I did was I took the projected AI market, the most optimistic estimate I could find. I gave NVIDIA a dominant share. I think 60% market share of that market, even though everybody's trying. And I revalued the company with that number built in, with the AI promise built in. I came up with about $240 per share. And I said at 400, you're overstretching. Market might have a story, but it's run too far with that story. So I said, look, now I bought NVIDIA at 30. It's now at 400. So it's a win for me, but I face a choice. Should I sell the stock because it's overvalued? Should I hold on to it because it's done so well and the story might have more room to run? I split the difference. I sold half my holding because I think being greedy is one of the worst sins you can commit as an investor. But I kept the other half because I think there is a real chance that NVIDIA could find a different market. Because in the last decade, there are three big markets that NVIDIA has been in first that have become big markets. The first was the gaming market. NVIDIA made the chips that drove the... Then it was a crypto market. Now it's the AI market. The first time you can say they were lucky. The second time they were really lucky. The third time you can argue that maybe there's a pattern here. I call it NVIDIA my opportunistic chip company, that it seems to find a way to get ahead of others in new markets just as they implode. So is it possible that NVIDIA is worth $400 per share? Yes, but for that to be justified, there's got to be another market about as big as AI out there that NVIDIA gets in first on. And I think it's plausible, but to invest today at $400, to go out and buy the shares, you're asking for too much. So my advice to people when they ask me, should I buy NVIDIA? I say, you have to make the judgment yourself, but you're building in expectations of not just AI dominance, but that they will dominate another big market that we haven't even heard about yet. That might be asking for too much as an investor. You got to make your own judgment.
You differentiate between investing and trading. Now you have explained your investment case for NVIDIA. But did your decision to keep half of your position, is that a kind of a trading bit?
There's a trading argument that could be made for holding on to NVIDIA. The trading argument is that you want to buy at a low price, sell at a high price. Right now, the mood and the momentum are in favor of NVIDIA, at least when it hit 400. And when mood and momentum are with you as a trader, you can make money even when something is overvalued. And if you know, NVIDIA went from $400 to $512 before it retraced it. And that's the problem with trading. Mood can give, but mood can take away. Momentum can give, it can take away. My desire to hold on to NVIDIA had less to do with trading and more to do with the valuation plausibility, that this company with a history of finding new markets and getting ahead could find another market. So I was willing to hold half my position.
Kind of an option on.
Exactly, an optionality argument. Mm. For this is a company that seems to have a history of finding options and making them work in their favor. And since I've already covered my cost five times over with the half that I sold, I'm willing to make a bet with the other half. And I was open about the fact that there's an internal contradiction here. As an investor, I tell people not to buy stock at 400. But at the same time, because I have something that's gone from 30 to 400 in my portfolio, I'm willing to set aside that advice. And I'm open about the fact that that is contradictory. And I do it to avoid what I think is what drives investors crazy, which is regret. Because if I sold all of my holding at 400 and the stock went to 600, for better or worse, I'm going to regret and say, I wish I'd held on. This way, I can either way say, look, I made my money if the stock goes to 200 on the half that I sold, or if it goes to 600 because I made more money on the. So either way, it looks like I come out feeling more comfortable with my decision. And that to me is something investors have to decide for themselves. What will make them feel more comfortable going forward? Selling everything, holding on to half. I told people what made me more comfortable, but I'm not suggesting that they have to do the same thing.
Uncertainty is key in valuation and in investing. What's your advice for private investors? How should they handle uncertainty when they try to make a decision about investing?
Don't try to avoid it. Don't try to deny it. Don't act like it doesn't exist. Accept the fact that it's part of life, part of it. It's a feature, not a bug. And many people view it as a bug. It's uncertainty. I want to make it go away. And what do? They pay people to make it go away. They pay consultants to make. And I say, look, uncertainty is going to be there whether you pay somebody $1 million or not. Just accept that it's reality, that it's part of investing, part of business. And I think all you can do is be adaptable, which is uncertainty means nature will throw surprises. An example of Hilton. You bought Hilton in November of 2019, thinking it was undervalued. March of 2020, the stock has collapsed. Nothing you can do about your original decision. Beating yourself up because you didn't foresee COVID coming is not going to help. Accept the fact that you're facing maximum uncertainty. Say, look, what's the best I can do now? Now, there's this notion of a sunk cost in finance, which is we tend as human beings to think about the costs that we've already incurred in time, in resources, on decisions we made, and we then throw good money after bad, trying to change decisions from the past. Now, and uncertainty is the same way. We try to repair mistakes we made in the past when, in fact, we should say, I've made a mistake, nothing I can do about it. What's the best thing I can do looking forward? It's not easy for anybody, including me, but it's something we almost have to train ourselves to do. And one of my books, The Dark Side of Valuation, is about coping mechanisms you can use for dealing with uncertainty. Because human beings, when faced with uncertainty, make unhealthy choices. Mm.
So you invest yourself. Could I ask how many stocks do you have in your portfolio, and right. How do you kind of what's your time frame? Do you trade or change a lot? Or
I mean, what I did with Nvidia is a typical example of a stock in my portfolio. Bought in 2018, I've sold half of it in 2023. My typical time horizon can vary from 2 years at the low end to to maintain sanity, a chunk of your portfolio has to be in boring things. You know, companies like 3M, which have been part of my portfolio, Coca-Cola, Nike, that have been there for 20 plus years. They're never massively undervalued. They're never massively overvalued, but they create this basis for my portfolio that keeps it from swinging wildly. Part of the reason I have 42 stocks in my portfolio is I need that foundation.
How many?
About 42.
Okay.
At any point in time. Yeah. I have roughly, you know, 3 dozen to 4 dozen stocks in my portfolio. Every year I add at the most 3 or 4 companies. I drop about 3 or 4. There is not much activity in my portfolio. No. one of the advantages of getting to a point where your portfolio is self-standing is you don't have to be trading every week or every month. Now, in fact, I'm drawing on a result which is well established in investing, that the more activity you have, the lower your returns tend to be as an investor. Okay? Because we tend to be active when we're emotionally, you know, affected. We tend to act, we tend to buy or sell when we're scared or when we're greedy. And those are often the worst times to buy or sell. So much of my portfolio is self-managing. I do revisit almost every company in my portfolio at regular intervals to make sure it's not something I should be shedding. Because I mean, I think in, you can't buy and forget something in your portfolio. You've got to revisit and make sure it's okay. But I think that at this point, there's not much maintenance required in my portfolio other than if something catches my eye and I say, you know, that looks interesting, I will take a look at it. Often after stock price collapses on a company, I say, that didn't look right. Maybe it's overreacted or the stock price goes too much. That's when I tend to look at companies and think about them from my portfolio. That's why I'm not an active money manager. An active money manager, this has got to be a full-time job. For me, this is not my full-time job. My full-time job is doing nothing, no, teaching, dabbling. Mm. So to me, investing is something I do to preserve and grow my wealth. It's not the center of my universe. It's not what I think about all through the day.
But you are a professional. You can value a company much faster than an ordinary investor. What kind of advice would you give an ordinary investor that is willing to spend some time, not full time, but some time on stock picking?
If you're going to be an investor and you want to learn valuation, it's not rocket science. I mean, I'd say, no, look, there's nothing professional about my NVIDIA investment. Very little of it is actually valuation mechanics. More of it is understanding business and bringing it to key inputs. My valuations tend to be parsimonious. Almost everything about that drives the value of a company can be boiled down to three inputs. Revenue growth, which captures the growth potential for this business. Operating margins over time, which captures the profitability of the business. And reinvestment, which captures how efficiently you can deliver growth. It's not, you know, something that you need to go through 50 pages of a finance textbook to do. The bigger part of valuation is just stepping back and thinking about, what does this company do? How does it make money, and can it keep doing that? That doesn't require valuation mechanics. Anybody can value companies. That's always been my contention when I teach my classes is by the end of the class, you will know as much about valuation mechanics as I do. There's nothing there. But if you want to get better at valuation, the way you get better at valuation is by actually valuing companies. If you avoid valuing your first company by saying, I don't know enough about valuing companies, you will never learn valuation. If you keep reading more books on valuation, getting ready to value first company, you will never learn about valuation. Just get your hands dirty. You don't have to invest in the first company value. You might not feel comfortable enough with it. But if you keep valuing companies each time you value a company, you will get both quicker in valuing companies and more comfortable with what you're doing. And at some point, you'll say, look, I'm ready to pull the trigger. I'm feeling comfortable enough in this valuation process to do it. But this isn't rocket science. Anybody should be able to do what I do.
But a lot of people pay for valuation. You have some...
I think they pay because they don't want to take responsibility for their decisions. That's, I think, the reality.
They pay McKinsey.
They pay Goldman Sachs. Mm. I mean, let's face it, in acquisitions, I think acquiring companies should be valuing target companies on their own. Why? Because it's their shareholders' money. Mm. Why would Goldman Sachs be in a better position to value a target company in a business you understand better than Goldman Sachs? But you know why you like to have Goldman Sachs do it? Because this way, if something goes wrong, you could say, Goldman Sachs told me to do it. I think it's not taking on the responsibility for your decisions. We as investors, we as companies investing other people's money need to take ownership of our decisions. The only way to do that is by ultimately deciding on our own, not letting other people on CNBC or on Goldman Sachs tell us what to do.
Hmm. valuing one and one company gives you a kind of idea of how the stock price should be. But when you aggregate it, would you say that the market is kind of a good proxy for the real valuation of companies, or are markets driven by something different, like hype or optimism, pessimism?
The two can both be right at the same time. Markets are driven by hype and mood and momentum, and they're pricing mechanisms. At the same time, for the average person, just playing along with markets might be your most effective investment strategy. I mean, there's a reason index funds beat 80% of active money managers in every single market in the world, in every single asset class. An index fund, you have zero transactions cost. You're basically tracking the market, but you're not paying somebody hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars to try to pick stocks. It's not that markets don't make mistakes. They make horrendous mistakes, huge mistakes. It's a question whether you can find those mistakes efficiently enough to make money. And the answer with most investors, including most professional investors, is no. We keep trying, but it's really difficult to beat that market. This should come as no surprise in the world we live in, right? I mean, I don't know about your readers, but when I pick a restaurant, I no longer read restaurant reviews. I go to Yelp. And especially in a part of the world where I'm not familiar with the restaurants, I look to see which restaurants have the most 5-star reviews, and that's where I go.
The wisdom of the crowd?
Yeah, because it is crowd wisdom. That's basically what we're saying. A reviewer might be an expert in restaurants, but the crowd judgment is often better than the reviewer. You want to watch something on TV? I go up and check out Rotten Tomatoes, see what the audience scoring is for a movie. I no longer read the New York Times review. We've turned our world over to crowd wisdom on everything else. Markets are the original crowd wisdom. A market price is a crowd judgment. And much of the time, that crowd judgment is better than any expert's view on the price. Not because crowds are always right, but there's an aggregation that happens in crowds. It's almost magical that we tend not to think about. But think about the tens of thousands of people with very different views of NVIDIA coming together and coming up to one market price. That's an amazing mechanism. And I tell people, look, I might disagree with market, but I'll always respect markets. Now, that's why when people say it's easy to beat the market, I know they know nothing about investing. It's not easy to beat the market. It's one of the most difficult tasks in the world. And before you do it, you got to do it with open eyes, which is you're entering into one of the toughest games in the world, beating the market.
Just one final question about non-listed equity, private equity. We have a discussion in Norway. We have the Sovereign Wealth Fund that invests basically as an index fund, global index fund. I have more than 9,000 companies, stocks invested in more than 9,000 companies. But it's a discussion, should they also invest in private equity? What would be your advice?
Why pay an intermediary, right? You're already one of the, there are only two sovereign funds in the world that I think hold their weight, punch above their weight. One is the Norwegian sovereign fund. The other is the Singapore, the Temasek, which is a Singapore fund. They're the only two funds that historically have been run as professional, it's a true professional money management, which is decisions were made based on investment judgments rather than what sounds right on mood and momentum. I mean, to give you an alternative, think about the Middle Eastern sovereign funds. I try to avoid every stock that the Saudi sovereign fund invests in because they have a history of chasing after stocks after they've been pushed up. So I think, the Norwegian sovereign fund does a good job on its own, at least it has done historically. Why pay a private equity guy to be your intermediary? Because that's all it is, right? Rather than you investing directly in businesses, you're paying somebody else to invest. It's not like they bring something special to the table or unique to the table. There are some things private equity can do that a Norwegian fund cannot. Maybe change the way businesses are run, take a more activist stance on changing management that maybe you don't want to be involved in, if that is a game you want to play, then maybe you can go through a KKR or a Blackstone to do it. But they're now public companies. I don't see the need to actually invest in a private equity fund in the traditional sense. So I think that, you know, I would not mess with something that's been done fairly well. So as long as you don't bring other considerations other than the fact that this is a fund designed to make money for the Norwegian taxpayers, the Norwegian, you know, populace as a whole, I think that, no, I would leave well enough alone.
But the argument is that more and more value creation is done outside the listed market before companies they are taken off, maybe, or before they are...
I think that's the hype, but is it true? The average venture capital in the last decade made about the same return as the S&P 500. The average private equity fund in the last decade made about the same as the S&P 500. You know why we think there's value creation? Because we think about this. There's a selection bias. The kinds of companies we read about are the companies where a venture capitalist invested $1 billion, it's gone public at $100 billion. We take the story and we extrapolate from there, acting, we forget the fact that the same venture capitalist invested in 30 other companies at $1 billion, 29 got wiped out, one made it to $100 billion, and we assume that that must be the kind of return that venture capitalists make. When I looked at the Instacart public offering last week, I actually took every venture capital round since the seed round. The venture capitalists invested in 2012 and 2013 and half of 2014 did well. Every venture capital investor since 2014 has underperformed the S&P 500. They overpriced it. You're saying the good venture capitalists got an early, Sequoia was one of the early venture capitalists, but they also in 2021 invested in Instacart at a $39 billion pricing. The company went public at $10 billion. Luckily for Sequoia, their first investment outweighed the second. This is not about good venture capitalists or bad venture capitalists. It's the fact that venture capitalists collectively is a risky asset class. We've come off a decade of relative success, but guess what? Move in. This ebbs and flows. And I wouldn't be chasing venture capital and private equity money because I've seen endowments do it on the assumption that that class, because let's face it, venture capital and private equity is not an asset class. It's just a different way of investing in an asset class, right? Equity is an asset class. Yeah. So I think it's just a different way. There's no reason to believe ex ante that somehow smarter people go to venture capital and private equity, that there are better payoffs. If there are higher payoffs, it's usually because they take on more risk. That's not a net plus.
Thank you very much. Thank you. This was very interesting.
Thank you.
Jeg håper du likte denne spesialepisoden med finansprofessor Aswath Damodaran om verdsettelse av børsnoterte selskaper. Vanligvis lages finansredaksjonen av mine kollegaer Anita Hoemsnes, Tor Christian Jensen og meg selv, Terje Erikstad, som finansredaktør I DN. Lytt gjerne til våre faste podcaster som publiseres hver onsdag. Vår produsent Gunnar Bløndal.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Du har nå hørt en podcast fra Dagens Næringsliv.